The Reset Podcast is a show about fresh starts. In business, career, relationships, health, and life in general, sometimes we all go forward to a new square one. Every moment is a new opportunity to begin again, and my guests will tell you how, when, and why they decided to reset their lives. I'm Franklin Taggart. Welcome to the Reset Podcast. Welcome, everybody, and this is another episode of The Reset with me, Franklin Taggart, and I am delighted today to be talking with someone who I've only recently met through a work situation that we're both involved in, Jennifer Spencer. I've known of Jennifer for a long time now. I'm just kind of hanging around the art scene in Northern Colorado. You hear Jennifer's name come up. But the context in which I met her was that we are both consultants for the Small Business Development Center in Larimer County. And so it took that for us to actually meet in person. But I'd like to welcome you, Jennifer. Thanks for being a guest today.
Hi, Franklin. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, Jennifer is, she is the dictionary picture of a Renaissance woman. She is an artist and an inventor and a business person, and we've got a lot to talk about. So where I'd like to start, Jennifer, is to talk a little bit about, let's go back when you were young.
Oh.
What were the things that propelled you toward these creative careers that you've been involved in?
Oh, gosh. That's a great question. Always I've been creative. I colored, I painted, I put on plays in my kitchen and recruited the neighbor children to be in the plays, which I wrote and costumed. I sang. My father, Franklin, he passed away last year. He was a really talented jazz pianist.
Oh,
and
cool.
So there was music in my home, songs that he would play the piano and I would sing. At Christmas, we did carols with all the people from our church and the neighbors. And so I always had music. As a child, my family valued cultural things. So my parents were school teachers. My mom stopped teaching when she had children. So we weren't a wealthy family, mm-hmm. but there was a priority for having symphony tickets, going to the free theater in the park, all of those things as I was growing up. So I think that environment that I grew in contributed quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. A lot of encouragement, it sounds like.
Yes.
Okay. And did you, as you grew up, did that encouragement continue? Or were there time periods where you might have faced people saying, well, that's not a very practical direction, or, you know, things like that?
It's curious. This is a very curious thing to talk about. My parents are very egalitarian. And believe that if, you know, of all their children are doing a good job, and all the people that they met, you know, they were teachers and they saw value in each individual. But I, Franklin, was this kind of ambitious, more competitive, high achiever, and I did not fit in the family, and that was not really supported. People who were successful or people who achieved something were exactly the same as people who didn't achieve something. And so for me, that was a pretty continual rub, because I would do something that I'd worked so hard on and they'd say, but that's just fine. And they loved me, but I just propelled forward. And so I didn't continue to have success with that necessarily.
Okay.
As it relates to, can I tell one other quick story?
Oh, sure.
As it relates to music, I thought originally, Franklin, that I would be in music. I thought I would be a performing musician. And I had performed all growing up with my dad, you know, around town and things. And in college, I said, you know, Dad, I think I'm going to do this. And he said, Jenny, you're not talented enough. You can't do it. You're not talented enough. And it really sent me reeling.
Yeah.
It was a real, I had fully expected a different response. And that particular statement was hard to roll with.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Well, I had no idea that music was a part of the equation either.
You're a musician, aren't you?
I am. That's been my longest career.
Yes.
And the area of the country that you're from is also a place that is pretty well known for some of its musical output.
Yes.
So the thing that I find very interesting about that is that at some point you took that potential for being a high achiever and you brought together several different threads of your life and you started to be involved in business. Can you talk a little bit about how that started?
Sure. I married a man out of college who was very desirous of being an entrepreneur. Mm. And always thinking of ideas. And so we would, you know, dabble in this or dabble in that. And often, Franklin, what was so interesting is that I would start it and I would get it going and figure out the distribution and do the things and hopefully get it to a lot, you know, a big enough position that he could quit his job and join it. So I had a lot of practice and I found that in business, particularly in business, the strategy part of business, there's a great deal of creativity.
Yeah.
Marketing strategy, a business strategy, figuring out how to monetize things is, for me, a very creative endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's high energy. There's so much timing to it. And I love that almost deadline that's associated with it.
Well, that's so cool. And tell me a little bit about the businesses that you've been involved in.
I know. Let's see. One that went, you know, there were businesses that succeeded and businesses that failed. But one that did pretty well, it was back when there were audio cassette tapes. What year does that put us?
I remember those. That would have ended in the mid-80s.
Yes. Okay. So sometime in the 80s, there was a business that did particularly well. It was a stop smoking program.
Oh.
And we recorded, knew about it because Teledyne Waterpik in Fort Collins, Colorado, had a product called One Step at a Time, which was a series of filters, and each one took a little bit more of the nicotine out. It worked better with a behavioral support program. So we just did the behavioral support program and we packaged it together and took it out to wellness departments were quite popular in corporations at the time. So we worked with General Motors and the FAA and all kinds of big companies that were trying to bring programs in for their employees. And then what happened if you may or may not remember this because I think mostly smokers remembered this. The nicotine patch came out.
Yeah.
So we modified our program to be an accompaniment to the nicotine patch. Again, the nicotine patch stepped you down in a slow manner. This behavioral support stepped you down in a slow manner. And what was curious is the pharmacist was required at the time of dispensing the nicotine patch to say to the patient, this nicotine patch will work better with a behavioral support program.
Okay.
So then we sold an over-the-counter pharmacy and they could say, and we have one right here. And so we had massive distribution. We were in every grocery, every pharmacy that you can think of. I mean, it worked well. It was a great one too. We were, you know, the product was first in. But another thing you might not remember is on one day, the FDA recalled the nicotine patch.
Yeah.
And the whole business failed in one day.
Oh,
it went from high flying to completely halted and returns. Every retailer in the country was returning this program and wanting a refund, and the company closed, and it was pretty devastating. It was,
ouch.
It was such a dramatic shift from one place to another.
Now, how did you pick up the pieces from that?
I don't know. I don't know. Of course, I don't know about other people. I know about me. And for me as a creative person, there are real highs and real lows.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of that has to do with the energy required to create something and the belief that you need to put behind it and the hope that you need to attach to it. So that when it's gone or when it's done, the fall is pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
And I fell pretty far on that. I mean, I have had episodes of depression, and I have had times when it took me months, if not years, to get myself back on track.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes a long time.
Yeah, especially when you have had such a success, and then the immediacy of the fall is so devastating and so complete.
Right. It's just precipitous. It just goes from one place to another in literally a day. And that was very hard.
That's amazing. Do
yeah.
you have a sense of how many businesses that you have started?
Not too many. I'd say 5 or 6.
Okay.
You know, in one way or another.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your inventing, because that's something that I find extraordinarily interesting and curious. When did you start having ideas for ways that you could create things that would make a difference for people?
Well, first let me say it's that the what you're saying is not too different from starting from a blank canvas and creating a painting.
Yeah.
So we could say it goes all the way back.
Okay.
We could say it goes back to inventing plays and costuming and, you know, writing songs and all of those things. I mean, the inventiveness of those activities, we could say goes all the way back. I actually, you know, the Stop Smoking program was something that I did. And then, you know, in this particular case, I invented, you know, winter gloves that work on touchscreens or technology around that.
Right.
You know, it was a question of timing. That's what made it possible and exciting, the invention part. It was, look, all of these people are fumbling through their purses, which were large, stylistically large bags at the time, to find their phone. They have their gloves on. They're missing their calls. I could look around and see people. And I said, you know, if I can do this within X period of time,
mm-hmm.
I'd have something that I could sell. And my mind immediately went to the marketing plan for it. That's where I live. So I just started working on it. And I guess it's a puzzle, and I like puzzles too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the idea was that you were able to create a glove that people can keep on and still use their smart devices.
And it hadn't been done.
That's awesome.
What was cool. I mean, think about it. That product introduced in 2010, and the iPhone, I think, came out at the end of 2008.
Yeah.
But we didn't even know that we needed something like this until approximately that time. We had no awareness that we even needed something like this.
Until it was there.
And then it could be solved, yes.
So tell me a little bit about the development of that product, and like, what were the processes that you had to learn in order to bring that to market?
So remember, I'm a creative person who has learned a lot of business skills, both working for myself and for other people. So
yeah.
It's like I come into that with those ideas, but I'm not an engineer. I don't have a textile degree. I don't know any of those things. So I don't know how to do it. But for me, that is never daunting. For me, the idea of an obstacle is that it's a challenge and I'll figure it out. And I like figuring those things out. So I did as much research as I could on how capacitive touchscreens work. Mm-hmm. And it's the bioelectricity of your body needs to come in contact with that capacitive screen. Mm-hmm. And in order for your body to have bioelectricity, moisture and salts need to be present on your skin. Mm-hmm. So I started with some basic thoughts like that and started working. And to be honest, anything conductive was going to work. Anything conductive. And so I just started experimenting with different materials. And then what I did is I made the determination that I wanted to use silver thread in the gloves. It was fairly widely used for different purposes. Mm-hmm. And I found a manufacturer in the United States who worked with silver thread. And then I worked for about 5 months exclusively on getting a meeting with the president of that company.
Oh, wow.
Because I didn't want to start at the bottom and come in. I wanted to start at the top and have resources available. So I did that. I didn't disclose what it was for. I think I called it a clean room glove. Mm-hmm. But I came in, I met with them. Their department worked with me to develop it. I mean, because I didn't invent gloves. Yeah. I didn't invent knitting. I didn't invent, what I did is put it all together in a way that made it work. And then as we did it, we could identify problems and then come up with solutions. And through that iterative process with that manufacturer, I was able to come up with the gloves. And I find that, Franklin, with people I work with now, often a manufacturer is willing to work with you if you're a potential high volume client.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can get resources. You have to be a good salesperson on the front side.
And you have to be diligent and you have to be persistent. It sounds like, mm-hmm. work in the months instead of the one-time email, I tried.
I tried to reach every single person that was, 6 degrees of separation. I worked every angle that I could possibly work to meet this person and tried every door that I could. And I did. It is very much it's a fine line between being a bother and being persistent. But in order to make it happen, if you don't keep trying, here's the two outcomes that I see. If they say, wow, this person is a bother, we don't want to work with them. Mm-hmm. That's the same option that you get if you send one email and don't do anything else.
Right.
But you could have the possibility that they respond to you and say, come here and we'll meet with you. We'll get a team and listen to what you have to say.
Amazing. That is so cool. I love that story. That to me has a lot of inspiration and a lot of motivation for if you have a good idea, really, really commit to seeing it through.
Yes.
That I think is almost as important as anything else is just that commitment.
Commitment is important because what the assumptions you make at the beginning may be close, but they are inevitably incorrect. And so you need to keep modifying, what your assumptions are and your expectations and moving toward the goal with every, with every challenge that you have in front of you.
Has that law already been attributed to anyone? Maybe we could call it Spencer's Law.
we'll do that. Well, let's do that. I like it.
But I love that insight that, the assumptions that you come in with are never, ever the ones that that prevail.
No.
I've never, ever seen that happen.
It's so And when you start, you're so confident. You're like, oh, I'm going to do this, and people are going to want to buy it because of this.
Yeah.
And this is how it's going to work. And it doesn't. But that doesn't mean the whole concept can't work.
Right.
Right.
So in the past few years, are you still working that? Are you still running that company? Or
no.
Involved in that company at all?
No, I sold. So I had a variety of intellectual property, mm-hmm. patents, trademarks, and copyrights on that. And a business, let's see. Another thing, frankly, that I believe about business is that in order to sell it, often you need to have proof of concept and proof of market.
Oh, absolutely.
And we had significant proof of concept. Mm-hmm. The U.S. military liked our gloves. Wow. Franklin, there was a time I'm sitting at home drinking a glass of white wine and the Pentagon calls. How fun is that?
That's so cool.
I'm sitting there one other time with a cup of coffee and the New York Times calls. I mean, all those, it was a simple, simple product that was very innovative, and we rolled it out in a powerful way. Anyway, I took an aside and I lost track of your question. You'll have to ask me again.
Well, I think what we were talking about was that you're no longer involved with that particular company.
No. That's right. I sold it all. The glove company was kind of at the intersection of outdoor and technology.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And technology moves so quickly. So during the time that I owned the business, Apple came out with Siri.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't know what Siri was. No one knew what it was. And we thought, wow, we've got $2 million worth of, inventory working through this process. If Siri comes out and we don't need our fingers anymore,
mm-hmm.
but no one's using their fingers, we are sunk. And having had the experience in the past where in one day things changed, I started looking for buyers when my patent issued, which had taken about 3 years.
Okay.
And I started looking for buyers. So I sold the business and the intellectual property in 2014.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
So now you are free to be focused almost fully on your art. Let's talk about your art for a little bit.
All right. Let's talk about art.
The biggest question that I have about your art is how do you, with so many different interests and so many balls in the air, how do you manage to still stay focused on your art in any meaningful way? That blows my mind because I look at my own life and all of the things that I'm trying to do. And the one thing that I don't do very much anymore is create music. And I'm just very curious about that for you. How do you manage that?
Well, I agree with you that it is a tricky area to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
My kids are grown. I don't have small children at home to make it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I need to say this is my work. And when friends say, I also work at the SBDC, and they all say, are you working today? And I have to say, yes, I'm painting today. And I don't interrupt that time. I set aside this particular time for painting. So I have certain days and certain times that are my painting days and times. And I try very hard to honor that and make that important. The other thing that I do, this is a time management thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have a list of things called things I can do in 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And it's amazing to me how many 10-minute, 20-minute periods of time throughout the day we let go. Because we say, oh, well, I've got to leave, it's 4:20 and I need to leave at 4:40.
Yeah.
And we don't do something. So I have a list of things I can do in 10 minutes. And I find if I do many of those 10-minute activities, my time is freed up for doing art in a bigger way.
That is so cool. What a great idea. I love that. really, really defining your activities by the amount of time that it takes rather than just making a list of things to do.
Right. The to-do list is daunting.
Yeah.
And it messes me up. When I start working from a list, I think, okay, I'm just going to take today and get through this list. But the fact of the matter is, if I do that tomorrow, the list magically has just as many things on it, new things.
Yeah.
And if I become list focused, then the list perpetuates itself. So what this does, this lives somewhere else. And the only things on my list are, you know, paint. Do these, you know, I mean, it just the biggies. The biggies are on, you know, I have five or six things on my list of things today. And then somewhere else lives these optional things that I can do in relative to time, not relative to a linear kind of way of thinking.
Tell me a little bit about how you bring your business experience into your art world. Talk to me about how business informs your career as an artist.
It is much harder to market myself as an artist than it is to market even a product that I had invented.
Mm.
The difference is that the place in my brain where business happens is very different than the place in my brain where art happens.
Mm.
And they may not be mutually exclusive, but they are somewhat different. It's the transition between going from business to art is difficult. Going from art to business is easy, but from business to art is often very difficult. So I guess I want to just start by saying it's harder. It's harder to do it, not because I couldn't market the paintings or I couldn't do those things. It's that it takes me away from painting in a creative and energetic kind of way that I find difficult to describe.
Yeah.
So what do? I look at, from a business perspective, what I'm trying to do. Well, I gave myself steps first. Myself steps. What do I need? For step one was, I can't, what is an artist? That was step one.
Mm-hmm.
What do I have to do to call myself an artist? And the answer was, you need to show your work publicly and you need to have sold something.
Okay.
I can't call myself an artist otherwise. Just like I do paint, I could say I paint.
Yeah.
Just like if I played touch football with my kids, I couldn't say I'm a football player. Or if I only write in my diary, I can't really say I'm a writer. I thought to myself, what is it? If I want to call myself an artist, mm-hmm. what does that mean? So then having to find that, I said, okay, well, got to show my work somewhere. I've got to get out there. So next I have to figure out how to get my work out. Well, that helped me.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of saying I need to show my work and I need to sell my work. What that does from a business perspective is it says, how do you get your work out of your studio and into a public place? And it says, how do I price this?
Yeah.
And then that opens up, oh, well, how do I price this? What do I need to know? How do I need to look at that? Let me pay attention to what other people are doing. Let me pay attention to what my cost of goods are on this.
Yeah.
You know, what am I putting into this painting? So even if that first step had some business aspects to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How... One of the biggest challenges that I know exists with most of the artists that I work with is articulating the value of what they do. Is there a way that you can talk about that?
Mm. It's an interesting puzzle to put together. We are in such a decentralized environment right now.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a musician found a label and the label would discover them and then represent them. And a writer would find a publisher and the publisher would take care of scheduling everything and getting the book distributed to the bookstores. And an artist would find a gallery and the gallery would sell it and be the selling part of that. So we live in a different time where those centralized curators are largely absent.
Yeah.
And that gives us an opportunity. So it's a challenge and an opportunity because we don't know how to sell in this decentralized market. How right. does the person who is the artist of any sort also become the seller and the curator of that? So that to me is kind of the dilemma and the question. Mm-hmm. So number one, I looked at branding, right? Any product that I have, I want to know what the brand is. What does it look like? Yeah. How does it feel? What does it look? And how am I going to define myself as an artist? Mm-hmm. So I took action steps to define myself as an artist and as a brand.
Okay.
Once I had started showing and started selling and things like that, that was one of the early steps that I took, is to say, I'm going to brand myself. And that I kind of did, you know, you do that through a variety of things, but mm-hmm. for a visual artist, you know, how you look on your website is kind of important.
Yes.
In terms of that branding.
Very good. Mm-hmm. What else did you do?
What I continually look at, and this is a longer process for me, is to determine where sales of art, visual art, are happening.
Yeah.
And what is the mechanism for that? So I saw artists that were selling online and, you know, modern abstract kind of painting, something similar to what I'm doing. And we're selling in places like West Elm online, yeah. or, you know, some of those modern furniture kind of places that also sell art. And I tracked it down. I just kept following step after step to see how had they submitted their art to this organization. How did they get that to happen? Mm-hmm. That was one thing I did, is I look at how can sales happen. It doesn't... I'm in Fort Collins, Colorado, mm-hmm. and lots of people come out to see art. Lots of people go out to hear music.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily buy it. They're very supportive of the artist, but they're not supportive of the art itself. I do sell art, yeah. but this isn't a big art selling town. So where is? How does one find that? So in trying to, you know, break down that online puzzle. Mm-hmm. I have really followed some of those. So another thing that I did, here's a little trick that I do. There are some, I'm going to call them catalogers, but I don't know that they have paper catalogs so much anymore, but that also sell art, right? And they, again, similar to what I did with the gloves and meeting the president of the company, I think, well, who is it in this organization that I need to meet?
Yeah.
So I go to LinkedIn. And I scroll, I find the company and I find 300 employees and I look through all of them and mm-hmm. I identify three that I think would be my top individuals. And I, you know, I send them be my friend or my contact on LinkedIn, send them that. And then I call and I find the number and I call and I ask for that person and I try someone on the list and, you know, I just keep being a detective in the whole process, you know, asking when, if I get anyone on the phone, well, how do they, you know, what's the, you know, what is your email address? Because then, you know, if you find the pattern for how the email address is, mm-hmm. you know, first initial, last name, name of company, then now I can send something to anyone in the company. So I, you know, I'm just kind of a detective looking at those things. Another thing that I do, Franklin, is I sometimes find people who used to work for my targeted company, yeah. ex-employees. Ex-employees are often happy to tell you all kinds of things. They no longer have loyalty. They've moved on for whatever reason. And you call and you say, hey, listen, I'm trying to reach this company Y over here that you used to work for. What's the best way? Who's the person that I need to, who's the real decision maker there?
Yeah.
And not, yeah, they'll tell you. Anyway, I do a little digging that way too.
That is awesome. I love it. Well, what I'm realizing in this conversation is that it could easily become a series.
There you go.
I mean, I just want to pick your brain for days. Let's talk, you know, let's keep this thing going. But I do realize that both of us are probably getting to the point where we need to do other things today. But I've really, really enjoyed hearing your stories and just getting to know a little bit more about you and how you're approaching this this life of creativity and business. Your story is very inspiring and exciting to me, and I just appreciate that so much. We need to let people know about a few things. First of all, yes. Let's talk about your website, jenniferspencerart.com.
.com.
And then you also have jenniferspencer.info. Is that right?
I have that for that tells a little bit of the story behind my what I did. That's not as quite as active, but that tells a little bit of the story of the glove story.
Okay. So jenniferspencerart.com.
Jenniferspencerart.com. Mm-hmm.
All right. And so that's a place where people can find out up-to-date information about where you're going to be showing, galleries where your art is available, and online sources and things like that. Do you also have, I'm imagining that you have a portal for your latest work there on your website? Would that be accurate?
That would not be accurate because I haven't updated it quite as recently, but I do have several shows coming up where people could come and see my work. Yeah, right. It'll be in Fort Collins, Colorado. And I think I should have had those dates in front of me. So you might have to do the dates.
I'll put that in the description. But you've got two shows coming up at the Carnegie Center in Fort Collins.
That's right. It's on 200 Matthew Street behind the Old Town Library.
Yeah.
And it's just a marvelous gallery. And the first show that I'm doing runs from about July 4th to July 21st. There's a reception that you can put in the notes that everyone is invited to. Mm-hmm. This is a marvelous group of abstract artists. Really, I felt so honored. This year they invited me to participate in this show. Mm-hmm. And these are artists that I hold in very high esteem that have been able to make themselves very successful as visual artists. So it will be a marvelous abstract show. It's called Driven to Abstraction. Mm-hmm. And then following that, it's something entirely different. I'm going to release some really large scale figurative work that I've done. They happen to be female nudes, and they're fierce and large. So, you know, 5 feet by 6 feet, something like that.
Wow.
They were really fun paintings to work on, and I'm doing that in a show then from the July 22nd to about August 4th, with another group of artists. It's a multimedia, so there are sculptors, there are soft fabric people who work with fabric, are other painters, there are people who work in wood, beautiful pieces that will be in that, an entirely different feel. So I'd encourage people to come to both events.
All right. We're going to make sure that specific dates and reception information is included in the description, both for the video and the podcast. Jennifer, I can't thank you enough for this time. This has been wonderful, and I just feel enriched by it. And I thank you with all that I have for being a guest
thank
today.
You. Oh, it was my pleasure, and I enjoyed the conversation too. Thanks, Franklin.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to listen to, subscribe, and review the Reset Podcast. The Reset Podcast features interviews, insights, and in-depth reflections that will help you navigate your own fresh start. If you'd like to be a guest or share an idea for a topic you'd like to hear about, please contact podcast@franklintaggart.com. I offer a wide range of services to people who are ready to live with clear direction, new possibilities, greater freedom, and unlimited creativity. If you're looking for a new beginning, I'm available to help you. More information is available at franklintaggart.com. The Reset Podcast is a production of Franklin Taggart and Make Your Own Way Media.
All rights reserved.